This episode of Bossible Podcast is sponsored by Evervest. Years ago, when I started my monthly savings, I spent months delving into the topic. Understanding and comparing all the different investment options was a huge effort. I read books, did some internet research, met with several investment advisors, and eventually decided to go with passive index funds. I wish Evervest had existed back then, because they basically do all this for you. Evervest uses algorithms and expert knowledge to build an investment portfolio that matches your goals and then helps you monitor and adjust your portfolio as needed. Evervest helps you focus on your other goals with the peace of mind that your long-term investments are taken care of. It's easy to get overwhelmed with this stuff, but the most important part of an investment plan is that you have one. Getting started is hard, but Evervest has made that very easy for you. As a Boss Level listener, you'll get your first 3 months free if you sign up at evervest.com/bosslevel. So 3 months free if you sign up at evervest.com/bosslevel. Now is a good time to start. You're listening to the Boss Level Podcast, and I'm your host, Sami Honkonen. This season, which is season number 3, has been going on for a while, and we are now nearing its end. At the end of the previous season, I took a break to focus on our band's album. This time, the reason is even bigger and more important. I'll give you a hint in the form of some audio. So, here goes. This is the reason why I want to clear my schedule for a few months. So, as you probably guessed, me and my wife are going to have a baby in a couple of weeks. The sound you heard was the sound of the baby's heartbeat. It's our first one and we're very excited. I want to make sure I can focus on the baby, so I'm cutting back on work. But don't worry, this is definitely not the end of the podcast. I love having great conversations with interesting people. After this episode, I still have one very important episode coming up. But after that episode, I'm going to be on a break until March or April. I haven't yet decided on dates since, from what I've understood, there's a good amount of uncertainty around dealing with a baby, so I don't want to set constraints that are too tight. I've already started making arrangements with guests for the fourth season, and it's going to be, well, boss level. If you're interested in sponsoring, now is a good time to get in touch. Before we get to the episode of the day, I want to remind you that Stanley McChrystal, the US general and author of Team of Teams, is coming to Helsinki next week. You can see the other speakers and apply for tickets to the event at the website reactor.com/leadershipupdate. Don't forget to mention Bossible when applying for tickets. It'll increase your chances of scoring one. Okay, now let's get to the episode. My guest is Sari Baldauf. Sari was selected as the most influential female executive in the year 1998 by Fortune magazine. In 2002, the Wall Street Journal named Baldauf as Europe's most successful female executive. Sari joined Nokia in 1983 and held several executive positions there. From 1998 to 2005, she was the general manager of Nokia's networks business. She sat on the executive board of Nokia from 1994 until January 2005. In the end of 2004, she resigned from Nokia for personal reasons. Since then, she's moved on to become a respected board professional, working as the chairwoman of the board at Fortum, the Finnish energy giant, and as a member of the board at Daimler, among other roles. We talk about her defining moments, her happiest and saddest times during her career, and her lessons learned on strategy and leadership. Meeting her was a delight, and the conversation could have continued for hours, but I'm pretty happy with how much of her experience and wisdom we were able to squeeze into this episode. Be sure to share it if you like it. Okay, let's get to it. Looking at your career so far, what do you consider to be your defining moments?
There are many defining moments when you have worked this long as I have, but actually I would say that perhaps the one and probably the most defining moment might be a bit surprising, because that's not something that happened when I've been working in corporate world, but that was actually earlier in time, or two defining moments were earlier in time. And the first one was when I was finishing, or I had just finished my studies at Helsinki School of Economics and Business Administration, and I was working in a research group called Finland's International Business Operations.
Okay.
And that time, of course, Finland, we didn't have that many really global companies, so we didn't have that many very international companies. And so we were in that group studying sort of how Finnish companies were doing and what perhaps we should pay more attention to, and did big empirical data gathering for that purpose. And what was defining about that? One was the fact that that's when I grew really interested in global and international business. One, but even more important was how that group worked together.
Oh, interesting.
We were about 10 people and all studying different aspects of this phenomenon. And it was led by one of the professors, Reijo Luostarinen from the school. The way everybody was totally committed to one's own work, but then also supporting each other and creating concepts and sort of improving the work together. And that's where I learned how to work in a team and how to run a team and how to benefit from diversity of the team. And many of those guys who were there, they are still my best friends. And I worked with many of them at Nokia. Pekka Ala-Pietilä was one of them. Mikko Kesonen was one of them. So that really has been, it was not a moment, it was a process, but really defining. And then I would say the other one was that soon after that, when I started working, then after finishing the studies, and I lived for a couple of years in Middle East, in Abu Dhabi. And I worked there in, I was very young, obviously, 25. And I worked for an American Arabian joint venture company. And it was a startup. So we were building the business. And we were small, but we were 12 different nationalities. That's when I learned cross-cultural working. So I think those perhaps are early on in my career, the defining moments. Then there were others when I started to work in real leadership positions.
So actually a theme that's combining both of those experiences is the diversity, I would say.
It's the diversity, yes. And then also sort of inclusion, bringing everybody to work together, sharing, and developing things further. Not very hierarchical, rather networked way of working,
yes,
which we talk a lot about these days.
Yes.
And that's when I kind of learned the power of that. And big element I would still add was trust.
Yes.
So that you, because if you trust, you can say quite openly what you think. And then you can come up with innovations and develop new ideas. If you feel that the others are not going to shoot you in your back, even if you say stupid things, because sometimes you do, for sure.
Of course.
And so diversity, then creating that kind of trusting, collaborative, at the same time, constructively critical, a dialogue, debate, kind of environment, I think. And then perhaps this Abu Dhabi experience, the big thing about that was that you really had to stop many times to think about sort of the cultural background the other people came from. Sort of the Nordic, straightforward, let's get down to the business and let's get this done. doesn't always work exactly like that. In some cultures, you need to do a little bit more cultivation and explaining and all of that.
Sure. Yeah. I find it interesting that one of your defining moments is the fact that you found a team that worked so well. Because I think a lot of people have a similar experience where they've, at some point during their career, they've had a moment where they were in a team that worked superbly well.
Yeah.
And they remember that for the rest of their career and
exactly.
try to figure out ways to create that same team or the same team dynamics elsewhere.
Exactly.
So I think when that clicks, you'll remember that.
Yeah, and I sort of, if I go further than the defining moments, that's exactly then at the time when I was working at Nokia.
Yeah.
And then again, sort of building the mobile infrastructure business and then they're building the team and having that kind of team. And when you sort of at the same time enormous amount of work, but then while working a lot, also having fun.
Yes.
Sometimes failing, sometimes succeeding, but sharing, and then again trusting, and then you get okay. People, I guess they talk about flow, but then you get to that kind of process where you work much better than you would on your own. You get much more done sort of together. So those are, that's the kind of thing when one really thrives.
Yeah. Okay. So you feel that throughout your career, one of the things that has kind of been crucial has been your ability to understand the importance of good teams and the importance of creating a good leadership team.
I think it is crucial because none of us get much done on our own. And it's also crucial, it is of course crucial within sort of when you build the team and then when you work with the people who work in the organization. But then in particular, if your business is sort of selling and developing and putting together systems for your customers and where their business depends on reliability of your system, then you also need to be able to create that kind of a good working relationship and team spirit between your team and the customer team. So it's equally important there. You need to develop trust. And then, of course, you need to walk your words, otherwise the trust goes quickly. But that is also extremely important because you help them, customers, to develop their business. So, yeah, I think, well, I'm very people-oriented person, so I find that very, that's core to me.
I think that if you want to create trust, you actually should try to get to know people as the whole people that they are and understand their whole context, their maybe something about their family and their like interests outside of work.
True.
And that's why like one of the things that I sometimes try to do is that when you go for lunch with team members, you don't talk about work. You try to like during lunch try to talk about things that are not related to work.
Yeah. And I agree with you. Of course, you need to deal with human beings as a whole. Human beings, work is one element of being a human. There are many other things. And then also the reason why it's very important is that sometimes people have issues in their private life that will have impact on their performance and capability to handle their work duties and be part of the team. So you need to have that good relationship with the people that they will tell you about those things so that you can take that into account and then also give some support and so. But then, of course, at the same time, it is kind of it's a bit careful line because you should not go beyond certain limit because some people want to keep more privacy. They don't want to open up about different things. But I do think it's important to spend time talking about other things than just work. And it's important sometimes to get out of the office
and
do something off-site. And even though you spent most of the day talking about strategy and business and all of that, you may do some sports together or something else together, go to theater or art exhibition, and then while doing that, talk about other things. But I think that is important.
Yeah, yeah. So what about thinking about all the ups and downs in your career and all of the things you've done? So what would you say, what's been your like happiest moments throughout your career?
Well, the happiest time, of course, were the times when we were building the international and global business sort of during 1990s, early 1990s. And we were growing more than sort of doubling the sales, more than 100% annually. And of course, there were a lot of problems because the growth was so fast. And we had to work extremely long hours, but those were happy problems.
Yes, it's good. It's a good problem to have.
They were happy problems. So the organization was like, it was too small for everything, and the processes were not built for that kind of thing. So we had to develop all of that while we were running. But that was fun because it is very energizing. And then when you have these successes and when you do that together, it sort of spreads throughout the organization. So I think that definitely was the happiest time. I probably looked the most tired in my entire life during that time because I never slept enough. But that was happy time. Yeah. That was very happy time.
So I guess the even though you're not sleeping that much and there's a lot of stress, I guess the fact that so many things are succeeding and the growth is so staggering that it's easier to live with all the sleep deprivation also,
sure.
And so on.
And then the other thing is, which then you see later when the growth is not so fast, is that of course growth kind of covers small mistakes.
Sure.
And then also true, yeah. It covers if you have some issues with your processes and maybe not. The efficiency is not so good in every respect. So what you have to, when you grow very fast, what you have to focus on is on those things that are most important. So priorities. So you have to think all the time that it's important to do the right things and not everything exactly right.
Yes.
But good enough and that kind of thing. And then later when the growth kind of slows down, then you have to start streamlining all of those things that were not so important when the growth was very fast.
And I think that one of the things is also that back then Nokia was also in a challenger position.
Very so much.
So it wasn't like a status thing. You had no status to kind of uphold. But no. You had only things to gain at that point.
Yeah, and then the only thing we had to uphold was customer satisfaction.
Sure.
And of course, commitment of our own people and the quality was definitely an issue. And we needed to work towards that all the time.
You don't consider yourself a perfectionist.
No.
No, you're not that detail oriented. I think one of the things that I have a technical background, and when I started moving into positions where my focus was more on people and less on things, I noticed that there was quite a shift because the things that made me good in like technical roles was being detail oriented and being good with details. And then when I started working more with people, it was actually the opposite. It was when you're very detail oriented and working with people and trying to be detail oriented in that context, it's actually can be very harmful.
But I think I had what I benefited personally extremely much, and I think also the business benefited from the fact that I have business background, so I don't have technological training. I spend a lot of time trying to understand radio technology and switching technology and all of that. So I knew that I could talk with the customers and I understood what they were talking about and I understood kind of the drivers or the core elements when you are developing what is important. What is important from customer's point of view for the system and for the different pieces of equipment. But I didn't understand and know down to the details, the technology. Then I had people working with me in my team who were very strong in technology, very excellent engineers, and who always wanted to build everything sort of bit by bit, and so that we had the whole construction. And I think it was very useful that we came from different directions. I would come from this vision saying that I think there are these following requirements the customers will need to be able to do with their investments. And I think this is going, because of that, towards this direction. And then they would come from these technological things and say, yeah, but yes, Ari, what does this mean to, I don't know, some pieces of equipment? And I say, I don't know, but let's try to figure it out. So we had both.
Yeah.
And I think that was very fruitful. We were, I admit, I think they were sometimes very frustrated with me. And I was sometimes very frustrated with them.
Oh, sure.
But we spent then a lot of time talking about it together and then came up with the understanding.
And I think in many ways that can be very helpful when you're not a technical expert on the topic that you're looking into. Then you can't like micromanage. You can't start talking about all the details.
No, and then you can ask questions that then may sometimes trigger totally new thinking in the brains of those who understand the technology better. They sort of, okay, maybe we could do that. And then they start thinking about the technical solution.
Sure, that's very interesting. Okay, we started with your happiest moments. How about your saddest moments?
Well, the saddest moments were then, as I already said earlier, that when you grow fast, that kind of masks also inefficiencies and things like that. And so after the internet bubble, when the market kind of almost halved or shrank immensely, so we had to then cut down the organization and also lay off people. That was the saddest time, because it is, and I think that is the kind of the downside. Of course, always. Downside that when you know the people, you worked with them for a very long time, and then you take that kind of approach that it's not only the work matters that you talk about, but you deal with them as specialist professionals, but human beings. And then when you have to do those actions, that was very difficult. It was I was personally very sad, and I think it was probably it was 2003 or something, no, two, three or two, but anyway, sort of that Easter when I went through the kind of the plans, what we had to do was not, it was not fun Easter, but I think that's also perfectly okay and right, and because sometimes people say that executives, they should not take these kind of things very personally, because you sometimes have to do those kind of things in order to make sure that the business can go on and other people can have work going forward. But I think it is perfectly okay to take it also emotionally and go through that, because then once you've done that, you do that emotional journey with yourself. It's much easier also to face the people, which you have to do also personally, because and discuss that.
Yeah, I would think that if you try to separate the emotion from that, then that will lead to a situation where you're not able to be empathetic to the people that you are dealing with.
That's exactly. You can't be empathetic, and then the other thing is that you lose authenticity, because if something like that does not have any impact on you, either you are,
sure,
you don't have any empathy, mm-hmm, you're a totally very cold person, or then you are not authentic.
Yeah.
And you sort of try to hide it, that this doesn't hurt me. Of course it hurts.
Yeah, and you should basically just accepted that you're human also, and it's totally okay for that to have an effect on me.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was a saddest.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine. Has he, like, when you look back on it now, like years later, has your perception of that situation changed in any way?
No, I think, sort of the kind of plans we put together and what we did was the right thing to do. And the happy thing is that the business is still there and has grown again and is global and consolidating other companies. All that industry has been in a very difficult situation. So I'm very happy.
You're talking about the networks.
Yeah, I'm talking about the networks side of the business. So I'm very happy about that. And I was yesterday in Oulu. I'm happy that there's still base station factory there and all of that. So not from that, but I think where it's been really helpful that one has gone through that kind of experience is that as someone responsible for doing the actions and living through that with the organization, because the thing, of course, is that afterwards, then you need to energize everybody else and you need to make sure that you get going again. And that's, I would say that that's in some ways even more demanding challenge because you go through this sadness journey yourself and then you sort of have to pick up yourself and then again start motivating other people because if you are not motivated, if you are not energetic, no one around you is going to be. So you need to do that and then you need to start building kind of the little victories and little things to celebrate and so that you get that spirit going again. But what I was saying is where this has been very helpful that then later when I've been serving on the boards of different companies and of course different companies have faced these kind of situations. The world situation has been and financial situation has been difficult over the past 10 years or so. There's been all kinds of issues and people have had big layoffs. So then you have sort of a kind of different kind of background to talk about the measures and talk about that with the CEO and CFO and sort of not only the numbers and cold numbers, but also what else you need to think about when the company is going through that kind of restructuring challenge. So I think that experience has kind of gotten different colors from different cultures than later. US deals with these kind of situations in a very different way as compared to, for example, Germany.
Sure. And I'm sure that the experience that you had is very helpful with the roles that you are now in and the different ways in which you can help the CEOs deal with this better now that you actually have gone through it yourself and understand the emotional journey.
Exactly, I understand what the CEO is going through and what the organization is going through. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. You said that after the layoffs and after the growth has kind of ceased, there's a difficult moment in picking up again and starting to move again. And I'm a big fan of like fake it till you make it, that even if you're not necessarily yet feeling the things that you want to feel, it's often better to start faking it and then you'll develop it. Did you have moments where you had to kind of fake it that you weren't really like necessarily by yourself feeling that energetic yet? But you felt that this is going, I need to be energetic. And then you started faking it and it
Sure. There are moments of that. But I strongly believe that you can do that only to a certain extent. And of course, it depends a little bit sort of how you use your personality in your job. I believe in not having too strong kind of role, but I believe it's better to be oneself. And the reason I believe that is better is simply that that then you don't have to waste energy of trying to pretend something being something that you are not.
Yes.
So that's very helpful. And then I think the other thing is that if you're authentic, you create easier trust around you. So those are the things. But then, of course, as a leader, you cannot show all your emotions.
Exactly.
You have to control yourself a little bit. And that's clear. So absolutely, there were moments when I felt more tired and perhaps not so optimistic as I tried to look as far as the others were concerned. So I would go to the ladies' room and bang my cheeks so that they would become red, and I would put lipstick and things like that. And then I would joke with my male colleagues that you don't that if you want to have my sort of blush, I'll give it to you too so that you can make your cheeks redder. But they always refused. They just said that how can you suddenly look as if you are not tired and all the rest are like that. And I said, I have this trick. I go to the ladies before this and then I come colored.
Yeah. And I think like things that like that where you can like externally create the things that you actually want to be, it'll help you create that internally too in many ways.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But it's a big actually, at least for me, sort of understanding how strongly you influence your environment. It's a big thing. It's a big responsibility. And I think it is something that each of us should think every day in whatever we do, because it's not only leadership positions. It's when we go to the shop or when we deal with the kids or when we deal with anybody, sort of just the kind of what energy, what type of energy we send has a huge impact on the environment and people around us. So, but that's,
That's very important. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
So what is something that you feel that you are really good at, that like something that you've always felt that this is something that I know and I know how to do, and something that has made you like helped you become a better person and also a better leader?
I think I'm pretty good at seeing or sensing weak signals. So I kind of I have these kind of antennas out of me that that I notice things and that's why I can read situations based on that. It's been very helpful with customers, because I can kind of detect things that they are thinking about, and then we may have been able then to develop something towards that. And the same kind of thing in meetings, because part of that is also detecting kind of the emotions and undercurrents that are influencing, and sort of based on that trying to understand where do we stand from different angles. So I think that on one side one could say that it's intuition, but I think part of that is that, but part of that is that just it's partly my brain works that way. I also read quite a bit of course, about future and different elements, but then I keep making these connections in my head. I notice something and then I tie it to framework in my head, and then I think about it later. So I think that's one. And then I'm a good at organizing. I'm not perfectionist, but I tend to think forward, sort of a few months forward. So I organize things, and I think of course, having been sort of leading teams, you learn that, because otherwise you become a bottleneck if you don't think ahead in time enough. You sort of, things end up at your table and people can't get things done. So I think I'm pretty good at that. And I think what has helped there is that I try to think my role as sort of, I think the biggest one of the big tasks a leader has is that you need to facilitate the work for others. You need to make it possible, enable the others to get their work done as well as possible. So you are facilitating. So you give directions, yeah. But big part of the role is to make sure that people can do what they need to do. And that's why you have to kind of live ahead in time. So I think I'm good at those two things.
Have you built up any like concrete practices or personal strategies for doing that? At least you mentioned that you read a lot about the future.
Well, I read and read different kind of things, but I think that's part of that. But I think big part of that is that you need to keep your own mind open. And it's not only mind, but just sort of your personality open so that you absorb and receive these signals. And what happens very easily to all of us when we lead very busy lives is that we sort of form a lot of kind of pretty rigid thinking models and concepts in our head. And without noticing, we sort of stop thinking about, we're analyzing things, we keep downloading. Sort of, you hear something, okay, this fits my thinking, this doesn't. It doesn't fit, I don't care. It goes kind of out of... And when you ask about kind of personal strategies here, I think when I stopped the sort of the executive role and I started to do different kinds of things and have a little bit, the time schedules are much more in my own hands these days than they used to be, and I don't anymore work 16 hours every day and so forth. So I have a lot more time to think. I have a lot more time to read. And soon after that, I realized, because then I had more time to read. I had time to read properly newspapers. I had time to read books and things like that. I realized that what kind of reading habit I had developed. I read extremely fast. So I would take a novel and I would finish it in 40 minutes because I read like speed reader, like I would have read sort of documents I had to read every day. And I didn't enjoy the sentences or anything like that. I just went through it. And then when I read the newspapers, I noticed that I had not paid attention to that, but I had built in my head, obviously, a kind of filter that said that the following words are important for me. Look for headlines where these are mentioned and skip everything else. I didn't even see these other things. So I read everything that had to do with telecommunications. I read everything that had to do with technology. And so, and little by little, I started to notice that, I read in an odd way. And then I quite consciously stop that and started to do it in a different way. And then also I realized that there are many things that had happened in the world during those very hectic years that I had no idea about. They had just gone over my head because they were not part of what I thought was kind of the focus and priority. And okay, I think it is healthy that you do that because otherwise your brain might burst or explode. But yeah.
Well, I think that's very, very interesting that you have such a like conscious experience of understanding that you're actually filtering and you're focusing on all the things that you're kind of, you've decided that these are within your focus. And I remember like every now and then you bump into these ads or people who talk about speed reading and the importance of speed reading. And I always struggle with that because like, I don't feel that the problem with the books that I read is the speed that I'm reading them. It's the speed that I can understand them in.
Sure,
it's not the reading that's a problem.
No. But then of course, if I can understand this happens to many people because you end up reading enormous amount of reports. And then, okay, if the organization works well, you have good summaries, but sometimes you just have to glance through a lot of material. So you develop that kind of that you sort of take a page, you look at that, and then you capture what's relevant. You don't read it, but you just capture the relevant, and you go like that. But that's not how you read novels,
yeah.
And that's not how you read literature. And that's why, because we in the beginning we spoke about the fact that it's important that you talk with your people about other things than just work. I think it is important for, well, in all people, but then also executives who very often lead very, very busy time, that they also spend time on other things than their business. Because otherwise, you limit yourself a lot as a human being. And I think perhaps that's something maybe we here in Nordics could stop to think about sometimes, because we tend to be so fact-oriented, analytical, and all that kind of thing. So we talk maybe less about philosophy and maybe less about arts or music and so. And for example, I see a difference in that when I look at Central European top leaders. You can have very interesting dinner discussions about music or plays or literature, history stuff like that. So it's good for each of us to take a bit time every now and then to do some other things.
That's very good. Let's move on to the topic of strategy. So you've been in top leadership roles for decades. So what do you see have been the biggest changes in regards to strategy over the years?
The language has gotten much more complicated.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, I would actually, I think the one difference probably is, even though in the earlier times also there was a lot of talk about scenarios and things like that, but especially now that when we think about the world situation now and sort of all the big changes that are going on, technology and environment related, and the fact that more and more of the people live kind of on the Asian side of this globe and all of this, it's very difficult to know what the future will look like. And it's always, of course, been difficult, but in particular now, it's very foggy. It's a lot of uncertainties. So one thing which I think is a kind of necessity now is to do these scenarios and try to kind of think through the assumptions and drivers for different alternative futures, so that you kind of build frameworks in your head that this could happen and this would drive this kind of thing and so. So I think that has become a lot more important. Apart from that, in my mind, the best strategies are very simple. They don't have very fancy language. And they are kind of easy enough so that the whole organization can understand what we are aiming to get done and why. And so they need to be communicated. So in that sense, I sometimes think that strategy is kind of mystified.
Yes,
far
so
too
many ways.
Much. And there's so many fads and kind of it gets complicated. And what I think is important is that you involve the organization. Not you can't involve everybody, but to a great extent in strategy work, because especially in this changing world, you need people kind of on the pulse
exactly.
of what's happening in different markets, what's happening in technology, what's happening. So, and you cannot possibly know these things in the head offices. So you need to have people out there who sense it and who breathe it every day, and then bring that knowledge to the company. So I think that's one thing. And then based on that and based on what you believe is the likely future, you just set your goals and targets. Then you prioritize not to try too many things, but focus on a few that are most important, and then make sure that implementation is reflected in every part of the organization. And that's the part of sort of getting it detailed enough so that it is demonstrated in like everybody's work, and then make everybody understand why we are doing this, which means a lot of communications. And that's a big role of leaders that I often felt like a walking head that was sent to different parts of the world to talk about the same things over and over again. But it's extremely important. And then not only talk, but also listen.
Sure. When you talk about the like being able to nail it down all the way to the details, one of the things that I feel is changing is that it's no longer possible for the top leadership to be able to understand all the details that are related to implementing a strategy. And in that sense, it will be important to for the strategy or for the direction that comes from top leadership to be, in a sense, a little more vague and
directional.
So it gives more kind of like leeway for people in the organization to decide on how to actually implement that strategy and how to make it happen.
And I think that is exactly how it is. And that, of course, is kind of a big challenge, in particular for large organizations. For example, I'm on the board of Daimler. And we all know what kind of changes the automobile industry is going to go through, and already is going through, but going to go through in the next few years, and then even more so when we think about a bit longer term future. And sort of when you are a huge organization with more than 130 billion in sales, hundreds of thousands of people all over the world, and then your kind of working model has been this kind of mass production of cars, and then all of a sudden these things that people use to move from one place to another, they are going to be a lot more intelligent, autonomous. They're not going to only be cars, but or something where you move, but places where you do a lot of things. Then the engine is not going to be combustion engine anymore, but it's going to be electric. And what does that mean? And then these things are going to be a lot more personalized. So this kind of mass that they are all black and a certain shape changes. It means enormous, enormous changes in the way the organizations work and their decision making and all of that. And these companies are doing enormous exercises in terms of, and here we come to an important element, and that's culture. Changing their culture, because culture eats strategy for breakfast, like someone has said, I think Drucker has said. So you have to work on the culture, and then you have to work on sort of your how you make decisions, how your different processes work. And these companies spend a lot of time, like for example in Daimler, sort of they've built teams from all over the world, from the younger generations, multicultural teams who are thinking again, kind of revising these decision-making processes, these other elements, how the company needs to change. And at the same time, of course, you have to run your current business and then you need to get ready for this new thing. So it's a huge challenge, very exciting.
Yes, I'm sure. Another thought that I want to run by you regarding large organizations implementing strategy is that we've talked a lot about involving people. And one of the interesting thoughts around this is also like, if you can turn it around so that instead of just people being involved, they would have an even more active role. And like how I mean that would happen would be that instead of asking them for input on strategy, they would actually be empowered to do experiments all the way through their work. Whenever, like, whatever they're doing, they're enabled and empowered to try to do experiments regarding the direction that the company should take. And then the strategy is sort of a result of experiments that we've already actively done and where we've already learned. And then we can, in a way, we can just start scaling up the experiments that we've already done.
Yeah, and I think that would be ideal way to develop strategy, and especially in the new areas. And a lot of that happens actually in companies. But it, of course, when we talk about large established companies, they have a big part of the business which is the current business, then they are trying to develop new things, and that's where this kind of thing is happening. And when I, if I go back to the early days of my career and my first kind of real P&L responsibility job, which then I did for many, many years, which was setting up this mobile infrastructure company. And so that's exactly, if I look at that from Nokia Corporation's point of view in those days, towards end of 1980s, it was an experiment. They told me that, sorry, and guys, look at this, an experiment, and see what you can do. And sort of whether you can develop the business. And I think actually the then time CEO, when he came to, okay, they were rough times in the company, corporate in that time, but Simo Vuorilehto, when he came to visit my team, then maybe 89 or something like that, he called us adventure business. Not venture, but adventure. Adventure business. And so I think to some ways it was like that. And then when we were building the organization there, the guiding principle was that we would try to push the decision making as close to those who knew the thing best. So it was a very shallow organization. But then, of course, and that happens in every organization and company, that when you grow up, when you grow bigger, you have to start developing a bit more hierarchical structures. And then the big thing then is that how you do that. And then when you do that, you really need to think that sort of what makes the strategy, what makes it possible to implement and execute the strategy. So in that sense, structure follows strategy. And you really, and then of course, then the kind of the responsibilities, they can change places during different phases of the organization. But that's a huge, huge challenge.
Sharing this episode on social media is one of the best ways in which you can show support for the podcast and help me make it in the future. If you recommend Boss Level to friends face-to-face and they don't know how to listen to podcasts yet, help them install an app. They'll thank you later when they find the wealth of experiences available via podcasts. One more episode coming up in this season of Boss Level Podcast. It'll be out in 2 weeks. Stay tuned.